Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around your iPhone. Get ready. Get Grandma out of the back room. Get everybody and get them off their iPads. And
you can listen to us on the iPad, too. But welcome again.
This Life.
Yeah, thank you to This Life. With a very special episode today, we have Cheryl Errett, who is a licensed clinical psychologist, a PsyD. And I've worked with Cheryl for many years. I'm very impressed with her abilities. And one of the things we're going to get into today is trauma. And we thank you for being here. And you're representing Alliant. Because
yes.
You taught there, or did you train there too?
I trained at CSPP, and then
the
California
School of Professional Psychology.
I was also an assistant adjunct professor.
I have a deep roots with Alliant and CSPP. I have lectured there. I've worked alongside of their students in their clinical rotations for
forever.
You did too,
yeah,
a decade
too.
And a half. Remember all that?
Everybody.
Was Bobby Thomas used to supervise them all. And they were some of them were you ended up hiring
Carlson, yeah,
you ended up hiring
like
some of them.
But they used to freak out when they'd sit in my group because I say I don't really care what they're feeling right now.
They'd
just see them tilt their head a little bit because they're just going around in a psych hospital where everybody cares what everybody feels.
Yeah.
And in our unit, it was like it'll change in about 11 minutes.
Yeah,
you got their attention.
No, the feelings wash all over the place. And to address that, we have another
man who washes feelings all over.
Very special guest, Tom Arnold. Tom, welcome.
Hey, buddy. It's an honor to be here and talk to you guys. And you've helped me out so many times. And, oh, boy, what are we doing today?
So Tom and I did his podcast. You can get it at Podcast One. It is 100% honest for the most. Say it again.
For the most part.
No. 100% honest, pretty much.
Pretty
Although
much.
When you were on, I had to be 100% honest.
We've gotten you back to 100% audience anyway, which is awesome. And in that particular podcast that's up, I believe right now, you certainly get it right now. Tom talked about his recent struggle with pharmaceutical medication, which it's the forgotten epidemic, which is the benzodiazepine epidemic, and. You should know that Bob is very worked up about this today.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, boy.
So, Tom, you and I known Carrie. I known Carrie for maybe 30 years.
Carrie Fisher.
Yeah. And it
came
out.
Yeah, me too.
The autopsy stuff came out this week, and I was shocked.
Not heart attack.
I was shocked.
Not heart attack. That means she was taking, when they're saying, let me interpret what we know so far. What they've said, it may be the complications of sleep apnea. The only way you die from sleep apnea
is drugs.
Medication.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Tom, you and I, I don't know if you remember, in the 80s with Timmons.
Of course.
So I've been around this thing as long as you. And back in the 80s when I got introduced to sobriety was sobriety.
Yeah.
And everybody knew what it was.
Yeah.
And now, 30 years later, it's just scrambled around like nobody knows what it is.
You know what's
anymore.
Weird? I was thinking about this today. Is that only the alcoholics get to have sobriety again. They've reclaimed sobriety. It's like it was originally designed for alcoholics. They got it because they're not messing around with the doctors. But the drug addicts have been usurped by the doctors because of how dangerous it is, to be fair, right?
Yeah.
That's not how you got – you get dragged.
Well, to be fair, in Chris's case, when you're an intravenous speedballing addict and you stay sober for 8-10 years – Valium seems like nothing.
Yeah, well.
And you think you can control it. I mean, I've had several friends go off that deep end, including Tom Arnold.
Right, exactly.
So tell us about that thinking.
Tell us exactly how you think. The first time you go to the doctor's office, you know what you're doing is wrong. Don't you, Tom?
You do. You
You hope
yeah,
not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what? You
hope not.
I'm a man that's taken a 20-year cake. So I know how to do things right, and then I know how to be slippery, and I also know, I also sit and listen to people I sponsored say things that apparently are not registering in my own head because I end up doing the exact, and I'm like, oh, no, I don't. I'm not a opiate guy. That will never happen to me.
Yeah.
Or benzo. I would never take a benzo because that'll make me fat. Yeah. Or whatever. And they're dying, and I'm seeing it, but it doesn't register once again because I'm not working that great program. And I spent And, you know, with Chris Cornell, it's the same thing. I mean, we had so many great, we were both doing great at meetings and had so much fun. And he, you know, we're doing so great. And Drew put me in touch with his wife, and who is a wonderful woman, a normie. And, you know, as we, her and my wife are going to talk.
Oh, good. That's perfect.
But the slippery, you know, and I'm telling you, I've seen it a lot of meetings. There's a kid, you know, that, and he's like, yeah, I'm, and he's helped, he helped me. I got him to help me do an intervention. You know, because I wanted to, he got 5 years, and he came through. He was a heroin guy that thought he would never get over it, never lose the obsession, and he's just stuck with it. I'm so proud of him. And then I said, that's great. And I said, what are you doing tonight? He goes, what I do every night. I'm going to take a sleeping pill, and then I'm going to go to sleep.
You,
like,
oh, my God.
What are the rules again? What are they? What's happening?
I know. You what know? Are the rules again?
But Bob is coming over to a point of view that I've been, I would say, advocating or championing, but concerned about for many years, which is it's my peers that are perpetrating this. They're
the middlemen. This is how I see it. Follow the money.
They don't understand addiction, though. They have
follow
no idea
the money,
what,
though.
I feel like Jesus. Don't judge them. They know not what they do. Forgive them.
How can a doctor, Tom, you know, you live in Brentwood still? You live in by Sunset?
I live in Beverly Hills.
Oh, okay, but where you used to live, right there in Brentwood Village, there's a doctor there. He's an addictionologist.
Well, that doesn't mean anything.
He has three offices, one in Brentwood, one in Beverly Hills, one in Malibu. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he has 250 clients per, and they're all on Suboxone. And he charges $500 a month to see him to re-up the Suboxone.
Crazy.
Times 750 times 500. Is that real money?
Yeah. No, I understand. That's the Suboxone.
That's better than working at Kaiser as a doctor, isn't it?
Way better. That's the Suboxone deal. But they don't know what they're doing.
They think they're saving lives. He's a friend of mine. I've talked to him. He thinks he's saving their lives by giving them no life.
Well, in some respects, that's the trade-off, right?
I know, but we need to get to an adult conversation in this country.
Yeah, I know.
About what is life.
You're singing the part. Let's go back to Tom, though. But again, I want to refer people over to the 100% honest.
Pretty much.
100% pretty much. Because we get into the benzo thing in great, great, great detail there. But today we brought Cheryl together with Tom because one of the missing pieces in some people's recovery is trauma treatment. And it's kind of a complicated phenomenon.
I can tell you why.
Well, because you can't do anything about it until we've been sober a while.
Because there's a flight to health. At 5 years, you think you're cured, you're fine, you're normal, you're high
functioning.
So they don't want to do it.
So
at the time when it starts to gurgle up, in me, I was forced to. My life collapsed at 4.5 years sober. So, and Drew was my boss. didn't seem like it at the time.
Well.
So I go to this therapist. He's a developmental psychologist. So he's walking me through the developmental stages. Mm-hmm. Apparently, I was in the infancy stage.
Okay. You should have been 4 or 5 at that point from the
I don't know how
thing,
I
right?
stayed. It was rock and roll that kept me infancy.
I see.
Fair enough.
So, and it was painful, and it felt, and it was boring. And it felt I kept it a secret from my sober friends.
Oh yeah,
okay.
Like you know.
So let's talk about it. One of the problems. Here's some of the issues on the table. And sure, I'll let you.
May I say one thing though, Drew?
Please.
This is me telling on me. A couple months ago, or 2 months, 2.5 months ago, Drew was on my podcast again, and out of the blue, he says to me, "You know, your son is turning 4 soon." And that's going to be trouble for you because that's when everything went to hell for you. Your mom left. You were turned over to the pedophile. You were whatever. And I said, he goes, you better be on top of that. And I laughed. And I was like, oh, I've taken care. Oh, I took care of that a long time ago. I took care of that in 89, but I got sober.
Tom, there's more, Tom. 2 weeks
after my son turned 4, I was in rehab and working on trauma stuff. So, okay,
you got the message. You got it.
Yes.
But Tom has even a more interesting phenomenon. He did this very, very vivid traumatic reenactment where he could never last a relationship. Almost a 4-year birthday of every relationship he terminated.
It was every
that was the magic
every
number.
Woman I was with, it lasted 4 years. By four engagements and by four marriages.
Wow,
and
Tom.
And of course, it took me a little bit to figure that out because.
Well, you got to have a lot of 4 years is to see the pattern.
He had to experiment. He had to
do
an experiment.
What a powerful thing for you to be doing something to really get out in front of that so that you can have more than 4 years doing things you want to do.
Well, I mean, as everybody knows, that's trauma therapy, okay? At first, you're like, well, you know, what is this? New age, how can this be real? How can this be, oh boy, I'm just going to have to surrender. This just doesn't seem, how can this possibly help? This is, you know, and the next thing that I noticed was the woman was sitting next to me with her head on my shoulder saying, feel your tears. And I go, I'm not crying. And she goes, yes, you are.
Oh, wow.
What is happening?
Wow.
What is happening to me?
Well, you know what? I had a little trauma treatment myself too, and the what is happening feeling is very characteristic, because you're wiring into a part of your brain or visiting a part of your brain that's been sitting there for a long time.
Right.
It's a part of you, but you didn't know it.
And it's actually by design, because trauma memories are undigested.
Yeah,
and they're so supercharged, and we get so triggered when we bump up against those that we tend to create our lives very carefully to not feel.
Well, not
those
just our
things.
Lives. I would argue our very wiring of our brain.
Exactly.
I always felt like I have a jump around. Like, you know, you can take a wire and put it here and put it there,
uh-huh.
and it will jump around these other
yeah.
wires.
Yeah.
That's what
yeah.
I have.
Because who wants
that's
to feel that, right?
Yeah. My therapist, Tom, said to me, when's the last time you cried? And I was like, I feel feelings. And he said, the last time you cried deeply.
Yeah.
Deeply and mourned your childhood, and really, you know what it means. And I remember I was 19, it was at my mother's funeral, right?
Mm.
I was 40 at this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I looked at my therapist at about 8 years in, and I said, you know, I think I've been depressed for the last 3 years mourning all this. Mm-hmm. She goes, yeah, pretty much. And I go, whoa, it takes a while to get through it. But go ahead, Tom, finish your experience.
Well, I kept saying, why, when that topic of crying first came up, I'm like, why do you want me to cry? What does that do? And by the way, I have found that women that say, well, I'd really like it if you cried. Yeah, you cry one too many times in front of a woman, and you're that guy. So I try to space it. I couldn't remember the last time that I had cried. But I'm going to let you guys talk, but I have to say this. As soon as they started going to the memory of the first time that I was dropped off, walked over to this man's house, because I was still not believing it, I could smell the laundry that was on the line. I knew exactly what was hanging there as we got to the door.
Yeah.
I knew what that front room smelled like. I knew that this sort of, not a box, but this wooden thing that he would put me into. I mean, everything. It was like it happened. It was happening right there. So that convinced me, perhaps I needed this.
But there's two things about trauma: is that it's happening all the time. Your body is the memory for it, and so it happens continuously. It never goes away. That's part
of
trauma.
One way of understanding it is that your fight or flight system gets disconnected from the present, so you forget how to tell when you're safe.
Yeah.
So what kind of, do you mind my asking, Tom?
Before you ask the question, one more thing I want to say is that I've realized lately, I was musing about doing some training for some residents or medical students, and I thought, God, I can remember every day of my training. Like, I can remember, the look, the eyebrows, how the facial movements of every one of my attendings and residents. I thought, what the hell? I said, they traumatized the shit out of me.
Yeah.
I was in trauma all the time. And you know what? Good. That's how you train somebody. The military does the same thing.
Yeah.
That's how you train certain kinds of things.
I tend to think there's an optimal window, though, of anxiety. If
whatever
you're too
was,
anxious,
it was
or
good.
Too low.
It was good. Anyway,
you had great
question.
Training. Yes, okay. Tom, I'm curious about what there are several different very good forms of trauma therapy, and I'm curious about what
Sounds like EMDR. He's in
are
too.
You doing EMDR?
Yeah, yeah, that's what it is. That's Yay. What it is. Is that Levine? Is that the guy that wrote the book?
Yes.
Robert Levine. Yeah. He's amazing.
Peter Levine?
Yeah.
Peter,
yeah.
Oh, you're
yeah,
right.
He's amazing.
I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. Peter Levine. Peter Levine is amazing and yes. does EMDR and has his own somatic work that.
You know,
that
I give.
Does.
I give. Remember Wake the Tiger?
Or it's yeah. called, yes, like, oh, that's there. Yeah, that's yeah. it.
I give that book to every patient. Yeah, remember that, it in the Celebrity
yeah.
Rehab.
Yeah, no, on the other show, I thought. Yeah,
everybody. No, I give it to everybody, and very few people read it. They read. Yeah. I remember Sean Young read it and went, "Oh yeah, I'm not ready."
Bai Ling read it, I think.
Really? Wow.
So, but one of the things that I always think of, like, we can talk on podcasts and we can be Los Angelians and whatever, but how we translate this to the massive millions of people in the United States that have suffered trauma.
Yeah, what they're
I think
doing
they
instead.
They don't believe in therapy.
Yes. They're doing instead is they're getting the internet and acting out as a mob.
We need. That's what they're doing. See, well, one thing that I think is it doesn't really matter. Just have faith and go. Because when you say this therapy over that therapy, people get confused. Like, right. I don't know what therapy I was in. I just know that after 7 or 8 years of that, I was a different person and could love my children. That's the only
so
thing
that's
I cared
good
about.
Therapy.
That's the only
yeah.
thing I cared about
that's
was
important.
Feeling love for my children. Right?
Right.
Yeah. I really appreciate the perspective that you have. As a trauma therapist, I really feel like it's important when you go that you go to somebody who really knows specifically about trauma.
I agree.
And there are lots of good forms of trauma therapy, but the one that the military did for the longest and the one that is really most established is something called prolonged exposure therapy that is very rough to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And can really help some people, but also can increase the negative symptoms in some people.
In a way, EMDR is kind of in that same zone, isn't it? Because you're re-exposing to the traumas,
they're
but
actually,
you're doing it different.
Well, it's.
But see,
it's
one thing can I say? I don't mean to interrupt, okay. but one thing, Drew says it all the time. He doesn't have to be an addict to be able to help addicts. He doesn't have to have cancer to be able to cure, treat cancer, right? Mm-hmm. I believe that it's not so important that the patient, like myself, understand what therapy they're in or whatever, as long as it's somebody
right.
they have attachment with
yeah.
that's knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And one thing you got to understand, it's every 20 visits you have to get authorized by your insurance.
Oh, I know.
It's crazy.
I
so
know.
So I think sometimes when we're in the helping field, we kind of are talking to a vacuum of elite people who
yeah.
can afford
right.
that kind of care.
It can sound like splitting
and,
hairs,
and,
too.
Yeah, and
if
I
you're
want
talking
people
about
to
technique.
Get therapy no matter what it is, just to talk to somebody
right.
because despair death is the leading cause of death of men in their white males in their 50s.
Take a little break on that happy note. Tom
hang in there, Tom.
Tom, you'll be fine. You'll be all right. Stay honest, man. 100% honest, pretty much. Tom Arnold, Cheryl Errett, CSPP Alliance. Check it out on our website. We'll take a little break. Be right back. Now, one of the most amazing parts of working in treatment is seeing a number of former patients successfully move on and choose to become mental health professionals themselves. Yes, I've seen it. And the field of psychology is vast, and the need for competent practitioners has not been greater and never been greater. If you're considering this rewarding career, I suggest you look at the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant University. I've been familiar with Alliant for some time now. I've spoken at their events. It was founded in 1969, boasts an alumni network of nearly 50,000 people worldwide. Alliant has fostered many of today's mental health pioneers, authors, and advocates. CSPP at Alliant University hosts both on-ground and online programs in business psychology, marriage and family therapy, clinical counseling. They also offer an APA-accredited doctoral program in clinical psychology that allows for specialization in child psychology, clinical forensic psychology, and integrated psychology. Faculty is industry leaders. Former faculty includes names like Abraham Maslow, Carl Rogers, Viktor Frankl. Come on now. Those are names everyone's heard, some of the fathers of modern psychology. For more information on the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant, check the Alliant banner on my site or visit Alliant, Alliant.edu. That is Alliant.edu. couple months ago, I introduced you to RefillWise. It's a prescription saving card you can get right now on your phone for free. And I was thrilled to hear many of you did so. You signed up, and that some of you have saved as much as $150 at every pharmacy visit. We heard these stories, and we appreciate them. Now, if you already have your RefillWise card on your phone, remember, you can't save unless you use it. You got to use the card on your phone. Just open the message, show it to your pharmacist next time you get a prescription filled. It is as easy as that. Just say, what can you do with this? Because it, you know, they'll give you, they'll decide for you what's the least expensive alternative. If you haven't done it yet, grab your phone and text Drew to the number 22822. Immediately, your RefillWise card will be sent to your screen. It's really fast. Just that's the word Drew, D-R-W, to a number 22822. And if you have an insurance, you might actually save more with the RefillWise card. And if you don't need the card today, chances are you know someone who's struggling with the high cost of medication, aren't we all now? Help them out by telling them about the RefillWise card. We appreciate that. Also excited to say that for every RefillWise user, every new user, they will donate $1 to the Prostate Cancer Foundation. That is a charity that's near and dear to my heart. And I want you to learn more about RefillWise. You can see if your medication could be covered. Just visit refillwise.com. But go ahead, let's do it now. Start saving right now. Text Drew, that is Drew, to the number 22822. Message and data rates may apply. RefillWise. Okay, we're back. That's, of course, our friends at Alliant and CSPP at the California School of Professional Psychology. All three of us worked very...
For all the 9 years that I worked with Drew, we had students in our rehab the whole time from your place.
And I lectured there, and you found the training good?
I loved it. Yeah. I really loved it. I went there after going to UCLA.
Sort of clinical stuff?
I had great research training initially, but I really wanted to go for graduate school to a place where people were actually working with people to help their lives and coming back and saying, hey, somebody came in last week and this happened and this is what works, and really loved the clinical piece, and I really got that.
Every time I flash on Cheryl and the magnitude of her professional training, and she's got tremendous training, I have to out her. And hey, Tom, do you remember the Burger King commercials from the 70s? The Burger King girl with the yellow and red hat?
That was you.
That's Cheryl.
That's why you look so familiar. I saw her outside in the car, and I was like,
she used to be on HLN all the time with us.
I'm looking that up on the internet.
You love the Burger King.
I love that you're so good at it. It's part of my adolescence. I remember it vividly.
Oh my god! So, part of my adolescence was listening to Love Line.
There you go. So we're back talking about trauma, Cheryl.
But mostly, I just really think that talking is something that's lost in our helping field. Both medical doctors used to talk to people.
Yeah.
Now they don't talk to people. The American public obviously suffers deep trauma. I don't know why or how.
Interpersonal trauma.
Drew's just suspicious there's more abuse than I want to believe
I was exposed to it through Loveline.
It's unbelievable.
The adverse childhood experience study by this famous California Kaiser adverse childhood experience study.
I read about it.
It's like, what is it, 65% of their patients had significant.
And then one in two females have been sexually.
And so just do the math.
It's so horrible. What is wrong with our society?
Well, Tom, what do you say?
Well, I also think if you look at politics these days, the people's reactions on both sides are so overblown.
Yeah.
There's some kind of trauma going on.
Yeah.
They're acting as though they've been victims of trauma, and they're acting out this way.
Yep.
You know, which is why I want to get better, because I have acted out. You know, I have responded to things as though I was, you know, not quite the same, but similar to being raped by that guy, you know, like when I've been with, especially dealings with men, you know, in physical situation or you know, where tense situations, and so because it's you know, I want to fix that so I could deal, you know. I can keep it like it should be.
No, I'm 100% with you. I mean, the last time, in my humble estimation, the last time that a population of children were so severely traumatized and then some giant political changes happened was 1790 France, and that did not go so well. But when you see these mobs emerge, and it's traumatized people connecting over their trauma and then acting out on one, the guillotine, whatever, the
right.
Losing the job, whatever it might be, Kathy Griffin, yes. Blah, 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 here it goes. It is extremely destructive and very dangerous, and I admire you, Tom, for looking at it that way. What does your friend Arnold, if you ever talk to him about this kind of thing, what does he think?
You know, it's so interesting. You know, back when George, I'll tell you guys this, back between George Bush, George W. Bush's first term and second term, I went over to his house. I got called over to his house, and I was sitting. You know, Arnold's a Republican. I love Arnold. I support Arnold. I campaigned for Arnold. He's a great. I support both good people on both sides.
Yeah.
But the George W.'s campaign managers were there, and they sat me down and they said, "How do we do an intervention?"
And I said
they had no idea, Arnold. You know, all these guys, they said there's been a problem, and I never, you know, the only reason I'm mentioning it now is because it was told to a big reporter at the Washington Post, but what I found fascinating was my friend Arnold went like this to me, and he was sincere. Oh my God, what an idiot! He's got the best job in the world. He's got the best job in the world, and he starts drinking again. How can that be? How stupid is that? And I said, no. How can he not start drinking?
Right.
That's how addicts think.
Yeah.
Well, it's the most stressful job in the world. How could you not do that?
Not only
you
stressful.
You got it wrong.
Think about all the magical.
And I made those guys, and they were so, look at me, and they were sincerely trying to, they were nice, but they had no idea about addiction.
You have a way because you're so kind of bringing up subjects that I was well aware of that, and I wasn't the biggest supporter. And I just compartmentalized the way I said it's not fair to talk about that. That's his personal business. It was weird.
Well, here's the deal.
You know, I did it. I'm a Democrat. I could have, if I was, but then I knew I would relapse. You know, I'm not going to share this. Yeah. But I also felt compassion for the man.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I had.
Get his
wife involved, get whatever. And then suddenly he's I'm reminded he's like me.
Yeah.
And once you realize somebody is like you, and boy, you have so much compassion for him. But all those guys, probably there was some congressman, senator, Arnold, who was the governor. I said, "You please study addiction. It's a disease. Please help me do something about it. Please learn something, guys." Yeah. But you know, from this, you know, because they were so naive, and it was such a moral thing to them.
Ugh.
And Arnold has really come around on that. And is helping
I'll
me.
Bet he has.
You know.
But think about how if you're the president, how you feel special, entitled, justified, stressed. All the reasons. Who's gonna be your peer? Who's gonna come up to you and go, "Hey, man, let's talk."
Right.
I could
see it in his eyes. I could see it. In
oh
his
yeah,
eyes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He didn't choke on a pretzel. Let's put it that way, or whatever.
Yeah.
But I had so much compassion for him because I was like, you know. If I was suddenly the president, I mean, who do you, what's your, you know, everything's got to be a secret. It's just so,
ugh.
So anyway.
Well, when you read when you read about what they went through with Betty Ford in the White House, it was unbelievable.
I'm wondering when we're going to hear about poor, what's Trump's son's name?
Barron.
Barron. No, Barron. The young one. I'm wondering when.
It's this video game.
I'm just concerned.
It's like every American kid.
Oh, the youngest. Well, you know, the Eric. You know, maybe 5 years ago, Trump kicked him out of the family. Eric is it's Don Jr. than Eric, and my friends brought him to Maui, and I think that he had a drink or two. I think that's why he was kicked out because.
Family history of it. The brother died.
Right.
The brother died of alcoholism.
Yeah.
But when I hear Trump talk about his brother, Fred, the humanity that he has, I don't see that in any other aspect of his life. But when he talks about his love for his brother, who had everything, but he was an alcoholic, I mean, he talks truly in a compassionate way. And it's the nicest I ever hear him talk. And then so this kid had screwed up like every kid, like people screw up.
Yeah.
And so I spent every day, because I was hosting little groups of things over there at Maui, talking to him about, you know, well, you know how dads are and this and that. And, you know, he had to work his way back into that weird family. We all have weird families, by the way, I've explained to him. And But you know, that's it's a you know, again, you know,
hey, Tom,
it's,
Tom, can I ask you one thing? You know so many families, and you're just like a guy that people trust and talk to. Drew and I have been going back and forth about the Trumps, right? So my thing is, Drew's thing is he's not as sick a narcissist as we all think because his kids love him. I know a lot of showbiz narcissists whose kids love them. Mm-hmm. I know it doesn't make clinical sense, but can you elaborate on the family system when you have a full-blown narcissist? Usually the children rebel from
that. Tom first.
This is what, you know, people talk about unconditional love, and people can talk about, you know, you get that in marriage. Well, you really don't. No offense, Susan, Drew. there are conditions. There are conditions. But when that baby is born, they're going to love you no matter. You can be the worst dad in the world or the best dad, so you might as well be the best dad because that kid's going to love you. And I have been around them enough. You know, I've known him for 30 years. He has treated all of them, including Don Jr., like dirt. Oh. And in front of people. And they love him. I mean, we all know how that goes. And he has a favorite. And it's very obvious who the favorite is. And it's not healthy. And, you know, if it's... he's not a guy, and he's admitted he had nothing to do with raising them, or, you know, he let the mothers do that. He doesn't show up for... you know, their birthday, if they don't do anything on Father's Day, but they love him, and it's sort of a weird...
So now we have a therapist. Him. Why that family? Let's not think of it as who it is, just that what that family he just described, what's the trauma going on there, and why is there the attachment to the abuser and all that kind of stuff?
Well, people attach to trauma.
Well, there are multiple layers and possibilities to all of this, and... without diagnosing anybody, when somebody does have a pathological narcissistic kind of character and they have children, they can very often experience their children as a narcissistic extension of themselves.
That's what's going on in LA over the place.
I would argue that's the American parenting strategy that went bad. That's why we have so much trouble right now. But go ahead.
It can be. So there is, in a sense, he wants to aggrandize them and control them and make them make him proud. But when you have access to those kinds of resources and you know that the carrot is very significant, but the stick is so brutal. I mean, we see what happens in this situation where anybody even doesn't I've heard him describe disloyalty as there were positive things people could do to help and they didn't do them. And so therefore they're disloyal to me. That's a very broad definition of disloyalty. The incentive to not incur the wrath, I think in certain circumstances, is so intense that it can really shape a person's behavior, and I imagine there's probably a lot of walking on eggshells.
Yeah, that's what I think.
What I've seen, you know, Don Jr. seems to be the most, the top dog amongst the kids, but I have seen it. I have been in a room where all of a sudden Don Jr. makes a little, like, a comment, and man, you know, like, yeah, not making fun of his father, but something that his father says, and then he makes, or rolls his eyes or whatever, and then the stick that he's hit with, he is put down so hard. It's like, you will remember that you are below me immediately, and it's brutal. What they're dealing with now is, you know, the their sister, who he just admires, her husband, who is probably going to go to prison, he's giving him all his love, the son-in-law. And so the sons are, they've been kind of pushed out. I mean, they go around, they talk about it, but in real life, they're not around him.
Wow.
He's around the son-in-law who's married to the daughter.
That could be a blessing or a curse, actually.
It reminds me so much of Andrew Jackson and the stuff he used to pull.
Oh, really?
No, this was his deal.
Let's go to another family dysfunction. My mom was a borderline, right? Mm-hmm. My sisters loved her. My dad was an alcoholic. I idolize, right? And there's been this lifetime completely different interpretations of a family system. Do you find that that's normal?
Oh, yeah.
To have different interpretations
yes.
from within the family?
Yes.
Absolutely.
So then why are the Trumps so aligned? Because you couldn't get me and my sisters to agree about anything about our parents, probably. And yet there's this alignment and a following of orders. And Druid said it's because he can't be as sick as we think he is.
No. Not that issue. That issue, I think, is more about the carrot. The carrot is so big.
I think, and I also feel like, and this is true from, you know, my friend was his executive producer for 12 years. He's the guy that talked to him between every take. They knew that he only remembered the last 10 seconds of anything you ever said to him. You could talk to him for 5 minutes, but he only remembered the last 10 seconds. The kids feel they need to help him. So it's that switch. You're trying to figure out a way to get the love. And then you're trying to, and now you're like, I'm going to protect this guy. I'm going to protect my father, and then he'll feel the love that way, and then he'll love me back. And that's really what's going on. And, you know, in my family, because we have a mixed family, you know, it is just chaos. You know, I only talk to a couple people, you know, because I was open about we've had a bunch of suicides in my family, and I work with, you know, a veteran commits suicide every 45 minutes. So yeah, I'm sure you know that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you know post-traumatic stress. I'm sure you deal with all this stuff. And those are issues I care about. My nephew's a veteran. It happened. I wrote about it. It was, you know, everything's a family secret. And I really found out what people really thought of me. And it put it awkward, you know, because some people were blood related to my stepmother and some weren't. And, you know, my father had passed away. And so, but it also helped me because then I knew immediately, well, I've been faking that I was, you know, part of this group of people for so many years, and I really haven't been. From day one, I was ostracized because I was the oldest kid. The day my dad buried the next door neighbor when I was 10, I was out.
And
so
can we just stop for a second? This is in the heartland, the good old heartland, Iowa. Drew. This is in Iowa where all people are smart and good.
Oh, I know.
It's the same stuff that goes on in L.A.
Conway had that, remember? He was the
absolutely.
Yeah. And it's so crazy that we have to have these idealized people that live in the Midwest. And then I always think of Tom and some of the bands that I knew from Minneapolis. I'm like, Jesus. Like,
Tom, you've been through so much.
So much.
And I'm so impressed with your openness, your vulnerability, your seeking the truth and daring to find it. I just think that is really extraordinary. And yes, there will be some people when you speak your truth who will have a hard time with it and will try to punish you. But it takes such courage and it leads to healing. And I just think it's wonderful.
He's always been like this, though.
React to that, though. Go ahead, Tom.
But, you know, I mean, I consider it. I mean, I wish that December 10th, 1989 was my sobriety date. I wish that. Or maybe in 86 when I went to my first meeting. That would be, because then I could say, I've been sober, whatever. You know, I wish that I had relapsed on opiates after my motorcycle wreck. And I wish that I had relapsed on benzos and lost my mind and had to deal with that. And by the way, that detox from benzos. Oh, my God, you were right.
It's
horrible.
It's terrible.
But I also can speak to all of that now, and I can speak honestly. And people can make fun of me or criticize or whatever, but, you know, I think it's an advantage. And I think it's not an advantage that I did it, but it's an advantage that we can all say we're flawed. You know, that Bob's talking about being 4.5 years sober and then having issues and then needing trauma therapy and just having to surrender to this weird thing that involves crying, you know. You know, I mean,
true.
You saying that, it just, you know, it helps people because it's foreign to people.
Can we just be funny for a second about the crying?
Before you do, I want people to roll the tape back if you have to and listen to the way Cheryl talked to Tom. That's what's called a holding environment. And we talked about how you know if you have a good therapist or not.
Yeah.
Try to tune into the feeling that she was creating for Tom in that moment. That's what you're looking for.
It's also what salesmen do.
Well,
it is. I'm sorry.
What?
It is. It's.
That wasn't what I was going to
say. I know that you weren't, but people are not unfamiliar with these things. They are around
us. No, listen. Then you missed it.
Because I saw it. I knew what she was doing.
What she was hearing is what the feeling that is being generated, and the quality of the environment that allows for safety, that you know you've got a deeply caring, safe environment. That it's not just, hey, man, just tell me your thoughts. It's not about talking.
No, it was reinforcing him.
He's so courageous. Too many words already. It was a feeling state. It was loaded with a bunch of words, but there was a feeling of holding. And that's what you're looking for, right?
Yeah. I you know, now that I think about that, and I'm playing this back, and I also noticed I was getting louder, you know, more emotional as I was, whatever she said.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna continue with my therapy, okay?
Okay, I just wanted you to know that I see something in you that is really valuable, and that it
that's another piece of all this, by the way, being seen and being felt and all that. That's what you're looking for.
And there are so many men in particular who've experienced abuse, particularly sexual abuse, trauma, those kinds of things, who are so...
Listen, I think emotional abuse by the parents, too, is something that's completely flushed under the rug.
Oh, it's all really significant. Yeah. But to have men like Tom be able to speak up and speak out in the way that he is can make it safer for a lot of guys in the Midwest or elsewhere to say, yeah, that's me, too.
Yeah.
And the fact that it went imperfectly to get sober...
I think
he didn't give up. He tried again.
Men have been traumatized by their moms in the last 20, 30 years or so. I think we really have been more than we're willing to admit.
Right.
You know. Then,
so we have a long history in this field of blaming the moms.
No, not blaming. I don't want to create another. I don't want to create another victim.
I understand.
Moms doing the best they could, whatever. But the men, I don't think we. I don't know, Tom, because a lot of your story is around your mom. And it's hard to admit that, right? Because you idealize
right.
mom.
It is. But you know, when she did die, I did feel. You know, I did that thing where I wrote my therapist what I'm mad about on half of the paper, which was you abandoned me, you did the other stuff, and then what I'm grateful for, and I'm like, what can I be grateful to this woman for? And then I realized, oh, I'm grateful she left me with my dad, who was an alcoholic. So it's the same thing, and so I took her. I paid off her seventh husband, who was already getting married 2 weeks after she died, and moved her to my grandparents where they were buried, and I think I made peace with that because I am half her. I mean, you know, she was an alcoholic, and that half flares up, and I have to acknowledge that. And but I will tell you this, I don't want it to sound horrible, but I had a male therapist, a great male trauma therapist. I went, you know, as you're auditing people, and I could tell it was going to be, I couldn't do it with him, but I could with the woman.
Yeah.
Because I have such a deference, not put on a pedestal, but it's, you know, I mean, I, you know, with men, there's a way of dealing with it, men, that I understand.
Yeah.
With women, you know, it felt safer, and it was something I was missing, maybe.
I could be vulnerable
in front of her.
I had the same experience in therapy, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Maybe that's why I feel so connected to you. But I know exactly what that is, and it's why we both reacted to Cheryl's thing. Bob didn't so much,
right?
But you want to go ahead and make fun of it. Go ahead, and make Tom Bob want to say
something
fun.
I'm not making fun of it.
You want to make you say she,
I'm
you
saying
said you wanted to say
the
something
things
funny.
That she said. I've been saying about Tom since the first time I met him. He is always genuine. He is always loving. He is shockingly honest about his marriage, when the marriage that he was in when I first met him, with people. It's always been like that. But I don't think he connected to... Because people have been saying that about him for 25 years, what you just said. But now he's connected to it. Mm. That's all I was saying. Right?
But you said you wanted to say something funny, though.
Well, I didn't want to make it light about the crying. So I like to destigmatize and demystify therapy. You can keep talking about this. People are still not going to go. People need to know that it has value, and here's what it feels like, here's what I went through with it, and I don't understand the shame about mental health issues in this country, and that's why there's such a high suicide rate.
Yep.
And the solution is talking, not medicine.
Or the solution is other people.
Yeah, other people. Other people. Yeah. So I had this therapist who didn't come from a background like me. And so he said, I want you to watch, have you seen the movie Titanic? It was when Titanic was on. I said, no, I will never see the movie Titanic ever until I die.
Not your thing.
Not my thing. And he said, well, something that will make you cry. And he wanted me to, by myself, watch something that I would be open and allow myself to cry. No one had to know about it. So I just disregarded it for a few months. Then I was watching West Wing, and no one was home, and I was watching it, and there was this end, it's one season finale, I think season 3. I just started crying, and I cried for an hour and a half, just sobbing on the ground. And it was the most cleansing thing. Yeah. And so people need to know how it works, because they're going to go there, they're defensive, yeah. they try to yeah. idealize everything, they have expectations, they're worried, they're nervous. Just know, you just go and you go, and the guy tells you you need to cry, watch Titanic. I was like, what are you talking about, Roland?
It just happens. It happens, and you don't even realize it. It's not like you, to me, it's just the tears are... You can't control. I mean, it just happens. And suddenly, and I'm going to tell you one really quick thing that, you know, my wife, I came back and we were having a bad day, and she said, you know, I don't know that you've ever completely made amends to me. And I said, of course I've made amends. I've done it with her. And then I pulled out my book, my journal from Crossroads, and I had the do not send letter to my wife that you write that, because you put everything in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read that to her. Making amends for everything. And I just meant like to, I wanted to read it to be, look at what I'm saying. And I was a puddle, weeping. I mean, like, it was so weird. I just, as though I'd lost control of everything. And then she was, and then she was like, that's good. That's good.
Was that recently?
And then I read my goodbye to drugs letter, and it was so violent that she made me quit reading it.
Oh,
but,
wow!
But you know, it's crying. You know,
Well, let me share my crying story. I was on an airplane. I was watching a movie called In America about an Irish family that came to this country.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Sheridan.
Yeah. And I started going. And I went, oh, my God. For the first time, I was able to differentiate in that moment when I was having my tears that family's pain and that character's pain from what had been mobilized in me. That my narcissism was such that it would always be one and the same. I couldn't tell. I just was mobilized. You know, I just said, it's pain. I got to make it. My codependency is what that was. And I have to relate so strongly, I have to make it stop in somebody else. And I thought, oh, that's his. But I still could feel it. And that was the first time that ever happened to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, guys, we kind of wrap things up, Tom. As always, you know, it's just a privilege to talk to you about this stuff. And good luck with all the trauma therapy. I'd love to hear the progress, how it goes. It changes and morphs. And what is interesting, I'll tell you, one thing to look forward to is your perspective on it will change. It's like you're looking at it from, you know what I mean? Like yes, somebody else is now looking at it. The new guy's looking at the trauma. As you move along, it will sort of morph and change, and new things will emerge, but you'll enjoy it much more as it goes along, and it won't be quite so mysterious.
I got it. Yeah. I got it. Well, again, like you've all said, I've surrendered. I am doing it. I'm present for it, and I am... And I'll talk to you in 8 years.
We'll see. I'll talk to you along the way, hopefully. All right, Tommy, other than your podcast, anywhere else you want to refer people to anything else?
Just check it out when you can. Tom Arnold, 100% honest, pretty much, on Podcast One.
It's a great pod. Do check out the one that Tom and I did, because we went more into the benzo thing. And Bob and I, we'll have more benzo conversations,
We'll have them.
Cheryl, thank you for being here for Tom and being such a great representative of not just Alliance CSPP, but just of what therapy should be.
So talking is better than benzos. Is that not true, Tom?
That is true.
Okay. All right.
It is true.
All right, I'll wrap it up. We'll see you.
By the way, I'm going to put on the song, My Name is Luke, and cry for a minute.
All right,
that's my crying song.
You are Luca.
Yeah, I know. That's I know. I get right in there. So don't tell anybody that, though.
All right, buddy. We'll see you next time.
All right, guys.
Bye.
I love you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bev.
Look for Cheryl on the Burger King commercial from the 80s. It was the 80s or 70s? What was it?
I was the 80s.
The 80s, yeah.
It was the 80s.
Yeah. Did you see it? You should go find it. Where can we find you?
You can find me at drarutt.com.
A-R-U-T-T.
A-R-U-T-T. You can find me on Twitter at drcherylarutt.com. And I have a new program that I'm working on to help people rewire their brains so that they can thrive and use all of the things that we're doing. You can find that on rewiretothrive.com.
Cool. Wow, good
name. We want to be a part of that.
Good name.
I'm into that. Oh, by the way, be sure to check out drdrew.com and check out the family of podcasts that we have there. And we'll see you next time.
A ball. Come on, come on, hide your face, misbehave, find your place, it's okay, you'll find your way in the masquerade. Come on, come on, hide your face, misbehave, find your place, it's okay, you'll find your way in the masquerade. A ball. Come on, come on, hide your face, misbehave, find your place, it's okay, you'll find your way in the masquerade, it's a masquerade. Come on, come on, hide your face, misbehave, find your place, it's okay, you'll find your way in the masquerade. Joe.